Power in the Blood. A John Jordan Mystery, Book 1, by Michael Lister. Performed by Kyle Tate. Chapter 13. There are four types of lockup in the Florida state prison system. Protective management lockup is for those who are at risk in the general prison population. Rapists, child molesters, ex-law enforcement officers. Close management dorms are for those who, because of their custody, crimes, and behavior on the inside, are confined to a cell. Confinement has two classifications, administrative and disciplinary. An inmate is placed in administrative confinement when the administration determines that it is best to do so, usually when he is under investigation for a crime. Disciplinary confinement is for those inmates who were accused of a crime and were found guilty. Jacobson was in the latter. Whereas most inmates in the Florida DOC are housed in open-bay military barrack-style dormitories, those in lockup are housed in single 6x9 cells. Some of the lockup cells house two inmates, some one. All have a sink, toilet, two bunks, and a very small window covered with steel mesh. Inmates in lockup are fed through a slot in the metal door, about the size of a food tray. Jacobson's was open, and I was talking to him through it. Squatting down to talk through the tray slot in the door always made my knees ache and my feet fall asleep. I usually chose to talk to an inmate through the tray slot because of the security hassle involved in arranging to meet him in his cell or the conference room. For me to enter an inmate's cell, he must be frisked and cuffed, and an officer must be present at all times. The same is involved if I meet with him in the conference room. Many times, what the inmate has to say to me is so short that being frisked and cuffed takes longer than our meeting. Other times, the inmate has a lot to say, but is unable or unwilling to because of the security officer standing within hearing distance. I was hoping that without an officer present, Jacobson would talk openly.
"Fuck you, motherfucker," he said.
Guess open communication wasn't going to be a problem. From the last cell down the corridor to my right, I could hear the inmate Starn yelling,
"Chaplain! Chaplain! Come here! Come here, Chaplain!"
He did that every time I came to confinement. It was Wednesday, and I had already seen him twice this week. Crouching down on the bare cement floor, I smelled the same odor I always did. Sleep. The stale air was thick. Drool, perspiration, halitosis. Behind me, the gray block wall was lined with empty milk cartons, wads of crumpled napkins, and various other items of trash the inmates had tossed out of their cells. Jacobson's cell was one of 20 along a long corridor. An officer, a round, bald-headed black man, was seated at the end of the hall. Another officer, a tall, slender man with strawberry blonde hair and pink cheeks, was crouched down by a food slot, about 5 cells down from me. "Nothing I can help you with?" I asked. "Nothing you'd like to talk about?"
I said, "Fuck you, motherfucker!"
From the next cell, an inmate yelled,
"Motherfucker, don't talk to the chaplain like that! You stupid son of a bitch ain't got no respect!"
Deciding to change my approach, I said, "From what I hear, you would. But I'm not interested."
"Ain't no punk," he said.
He may or may not have been a punk, but what he looked like was a neo-Nazi serial killer. Shaved head, pale white skin, sparse beard, prison green tattoos, shark eyes. "What are you then?" I asked.
"I'm Satan, man," he hissed.
"Don't be so hard on yourself," I said.
"Shit, don't be so hard on Satan," the inmate to my left said, and started laughing.
"You come to cast me out, holy man?"
Jacobson asked. "Actually, I just wanted to see if there was anything I could do for you, and maybe ask you a few questions." Somewhere in another corridor, a steel door slammed. The noise bounced off the concrete walls and floors and reverberated through confinement.
"We're locked in now, boys," another inmate said.
"Nothing you could do for me," Jacobson said. "I'm well taken care of. What you really mean is, There's something I can do for you. You need something I have.
Chaplain! Chaplain!
Starn continued to call. Which is what? I asked.
Secrets.
The officer's radio sounded at the same time, and because of their distance apart and the cement surroundings, every word was doubled. What makes you think I want to know your secrets? I said.
I see evil. I hear evil. I speak evil.
What sort of things? I asked.
I've crossed my heart, hope to die. Watch it, or I'll stick a needle in your eye. I'll cast you out, holy man. I can have you stuck just like Johnson. Was it in his eye? COs are so sloppy. I heard it was messy. Did all his blood drain out? There's power in the blood. Life and death. Atonement's in the blood. But I guess you know that. You think he atoned for his sins?
Chaplain! 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 I need you!
Starn yelled. You had Johnson stuck. What was his sin? I asked.
I can have anybody I want to stuck, he said.
As he talked, he widened and narrowed his eyes.
But I like sticking pigs best, he added. Hickory dickory dock. Johnson didn't have a cock, but he got one. Every night. And now he's taken flight.
Chaplain! Chaplain!
Starn yelled, his voice sounding sad and whiny. Did you have Johnson stuck?
The pig had him stuck, because he was tired of getting stuck in the butt.
He jumped up suddenly from his crouched position at the slot and began dancing around the cell, crashing into the sink, bed, and walls as he did. Then he started singing.
There is power, power, wonder-working power in the blood of the Lamb.
Jacobson, I said. Jacobson!
Power, power, wonder-working power in the blood of the Lamb.
Evidently, the officer at the nearby cell heard me and rushed over and looked through the narrow glass window of the cell door. He yelled for the other officer, who was still seated at the end of the hall, to come quickly and began to fumble for his keys.
Chaplain! Chaplain!
Step back, Father, please, he said.
His voice was an octave higher from the excitement, his fine strawberry blonde hair moving about as he moved, and his face, previously pink, was now deep red. I complied. He pulled the handcuffs from the back of his belt and opened them. As soon as the rotund black officer joined him, Strawberry Blonde unlocked the door and stepped in, Rotund following closely behind him. As Rotund entered the cell, I could have sworn I saw him smile.
Would you be free from the burden of sin? There's power in the blood. Power in the blood.
Strawberry Blonde told Jacobson to assume the position. Jacobson responded with many colorful obscenities, some of which I had never heard before. Suddenly, Jacobson was on the floor. It happened so quickly, it took me a moment to realize that it had. While Strawberry Blonde was telling Jacobson to turn around and spread his legs, Rotund stepped up and punched him hard at the base of the neck. In a matter of moments, Jacobson was cuffed, face down on the rough concrete floor, then snatched up to his feet, a mild abrasion now on his forehead.
Let's get him to medical, Rotund said. See about these cuts.
Then he added to Jacobson,
next time, I'm using the gas.
You better ask your captain first, Jacobson whispered.
Nobody touch this blood, Rotund said, as if he hadn't heard Jacobson. It's bad blood in more ways than one.
Let me call the OIC first, Strawberry Blonde said, beginning to walk back toward his desk.
Chaplain, can I talk with you for a minute?
Sure, I said, looking back at Jacobson, who stared blankly at the wall in front of him. As we walked down to the officer's desk at the end of the corridor, I learned that Strawberry's name was Rogers. When we passed by Starn's cell, I stopped and looked in.
Chaplain, Starn asked, do you believe that a demon can possess a man?
We already talked about this, Starn, I said.
I'm scared,
he said in the small voice of a scared child.
Satan wants me.
Nothing spiritual, good or bad, can happen to you that you don't allow, I said. I'll come back and talk to you again in a few minutes. Okay?
Okay,
he said in an upbeat voice, soothed like a child. When Rogers and I reached his desk, he sat down. I stood across from him.
What happened to make him go off like that?
He asked. I really couldn't say. He was okay, and then all of a sudden, he exploded. Does he often do that?
He does pretty much whatever he wants around here, he said.
What do you mean? He frowned.
Certain inmates are looked out for around here.
Who gives that kind of preferential treatment to an inmate as unstable as he is?
He's not unstable. He's a damn actor. Did you say anything about Johnson to him?
I nodded. Why?
That's the only thing he seems to genuinely get upset about. I think he's scared for real about that.
Do you think he had anything to do with it?
He had everything to do with Johnson. They were both down here constantly. So either he had something to do with it, or it scared him shitless. Excuse my language. Because he didn't.
Like, if he didn't do it, it was done in part as a message to him? I asked.
Think about how it was done, he said. It was a message to someone.
I nodded. No doubt. Rotund yelled from down the hall.
Come on, what's taking so long?
Just a minute, Rogers yelled back. I glanced at my watch. It was almost time for my meeting with Tom Daniels and Edward Stone.
What's going to happen to Jacobson? He'll be taken to medical, checked out, and probably taken to the isolation cell and sedated and watched for 24 hours. That is, unless Captain Skipper cuts him out. Then he could be sent back down here, or who knows? There's no telling. Hell, I just work here.
What's the difference in being confined in one cell as opposed to another?
Not much during the day, but I've heard at night, all sorts of weird shit happens in here.
14. They looked like men sitting around a barber shop on Saturday morning. Nowhere to go, nowhere they had to be. Nothing but time to kill. Inmates don't have much, but what they have, time, they have a lot of. They sat around the chapel library under the watchful eye of the officer temporarily assigned to watch them until my new assistant, a Jewish chaplain, was hired next month. Mr. Smith and three other inmates were reading Decision Magazine, the monthly magazine that the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association faithfully sent us free of charge. Mr. Smith and one of the other inmates were wearing headphones, listening to gospel music or a recorded sermon. On my way to meet with the warden and the IG, I decided to stop by the chapel to check in on things. When Mr. Smith saw me, he jumped up and walked out into the hallway where I was unlocking my office door.
These two will want to see you, chaplain.
Okay, I said, but it will have to be when I get back. I've got a meeting with the warden in about 10 minutes.
I tell them to wait. So hot out there, they won't mind. Besides, they got nothing else to do.
Thank you, I said, and walked into my office. As I closed the door, the phone began to ring. Chaplain Jordan, I said into the receiver.
This the chaplain?
A distressed female voice asked.
It is, I said. How can I help you?
This is Veronica Simpson. My husband Charles Simpson is an inmate there. I need to talk to him. I haven't heard from him in 4 months, and I need to talk to him right now. I'm not playing with you, and I'm not crazy, but I've got a gun to my head, and I'm going to use it on myself and his 2-year-old son if I can't talk to him right now.
Okay, I said. Now listen to me. I will let you talk to your husband, so just put the gun down and relax.
I'm not crazy, I swear,
she added quickly, her voice seeming to gain strength.
If I can just talk to him, I won't kill myself.
The thing is, he is not here right now, I said, talking very slowly. It will take a few minutes, but I will have him called up right away. So why don't we talk until he gets here? Would that be okay?
That would be okay, she said softly.
She was beginning to sound calmer. I have to ask you to hold on a minute while I call down to his dorm and have him sent up here. Is that okay?
That's okay. I'm not going anywhere. I'm all right, Preacher. I just want to talk to my husband. I won't do anything foolish. Promise. Just as long as I can talk to him.
As quickly as I could, I pressed hold, then the second line, and punched in the number to the control room. Without going into much detail, I told the sergeant in the control room to find Simpson and get him to my office as soon as humanly possible. I then punched line one again, hoping she'd still be there. She was. We talked about 5 minutes, waiting for her husband to come to my office. Our conversation dealt primarily with all the pressures she faced being a single mom, whose husband was incarcerated. I actually felt as if I did her some good, but chances were, I'd never know. When Simpson finally did arrive, after what seemed like days, I quickly put him on the phone and went into the other office, where I called the Tampa police and reported her threat of suicide. While talking to her, I had discovered where she lived, and I told them. I then jotted down a few notes about what had transpired and called the OIC and filled him in. He advised me to fill out an incident report, which I did. I then walked back into my office and sat down at my desk. Noticing that Simpson was crying, I busied myself with opening the rest of my mail. My mail consisted of roughly 15 requests from inmates for everything from Bibles and greeting cards to phone calls. There were also 2 letters from citizen volunteers who ministered at the prison, saying what a blessing they themselves were. A memo from the chaplaincy administrator about upcoming religious holidays that were to be observed by the Jewish, Muslim, and Christian inmates. And a single piece of typing paper tri-folded and taped together on the end, with the word chaplain typed on the outside. I unfolded the typing paper, tearing it slightly while removing the tape. It read, I've seen you talking to her. I watch over her. If you don't stay away from her, I will kill you like I did that little bastard yesterday. She's an angel, and I'm her guardian. She's mine. Stay away from her. I reached into my desk and pulled out the request from Ike Johnson. I laid them both on the desk in front of me and began to compare them. Within seconds, I could tell they were typed on the same machine. I thought of Anna as I reread the note. I'm sorry. What did you say? I said, when I realized Simpson was talking to me.
Thank you, Chaplain. I think she's going to be all right. I should have called her or written or something. It's my fault. But this place is getting to me. I don't know what to do.
Why don't you start coming to see me every week for a while? And you might want to think about seeing the psych specialist as well.
Okay, he said. I will.
And stay in touch with your wife. It's tough in here, but it's tough for her out there, too.
I know. I will. Thank you.
15. The warden's office was neat, orderly, and as conservative as he was, with one exception. In the center of his wall of fame, amid the diplomas, merit certificates, and department commendations, was a hand-drawn picture of a family, a husband, a wife, and a child. The artist used crayons and showed great potential. Potential he never got to live up to because of his untimely death at 8 years old. Edward Stone and his wife never tried for children again after that.
You're late, Stone said.
Sorry.
Let's get to it. Don't have much time left. But first, shut the door.
I did, then took the chair next to Daniels.
Inspector, what do we have so far? Stone asked.
In some ways, a great deal of information, he said, sitting up and leaning forward slightly. But in other ways, not very much at all. I am finding your people very uncooperative.
Daniels looked as if a day's work felt like a week's. His shirt ballooned out just over his belt, the way you would expect it to if it had been worn all day without a retuck. His face was red, and large conspicuous drops of sweat trickled down the sides of his cheeks. "Surely the chaplain has been helpful with this," Stone said. Unlike Daniels, Stone looked as if he had just finished getting dressed, morning fresh and military crisp. Daniels began to speak, but I jumped in. "As soon as you left us this morning, the inspector expressed his desire to work alone and left."
"Inspector?" Stone said.
"I've made it clear from the very beginning that I won't work with him," Daniels said,
the sweat on his forehead increasing.
"I am fully capable of conducting this investigation on my own. I certainly don't need someone like him botching up my case."
"If, as you say, you are fully capable of conducting this investigation on your own, how is it that you are having difficulty doing so?" Stone asked.
"I'm not having difficulty investigating. I'm having difficulty with these mother-loving rednecks around here. I have gathered a lot of information about the inmate who was killed, though."
Daniels withdrew a wrinkled, soiled handkerchief from his back left pants pocket and wiped his forehead. It merely smeared the sweat around. It also left some lint on his eyebrow.
"But you will work together, or I will call the secretary. Understood?"
Daniels didn't respond.
"Understood?" Stone said again.
Daniels made a slight nod with his head.
"Understood?"
Stone repeated, looking at me. Nodding, I said, "I understood it the first time."
"Now tell me what you have, Inspector," Stone said.
"I can tell you that Johnson was murdered," Daniels said, with a swell of pride that changed his posture. "The inmate was unconscious before he was ever placed in the bag. ME says he was full of enough chloral hydrate to be dead soon anyway."
"What is chloral hydrate?" Stone asked.
"Sleeping pills."
"Couldn't he have taken them himself?" Stone said. "Maybe to relax during his escape? Or because he wanted to die?"
"I don't think so. I think he was drugged by someone who knew that putting him in the trash bag would get him stabbed to death."
"Did the ME say how the drug was administered?" I asked. Medical personnel might use a syringe. An officer might put it in food. Another inmate might give it to him as a pill or powder and tell him it's some other kind of drug. Daniels's face turned even redder. It was obvious he hadn't asked.
"He was unable to say conclusively," he said. "We should know shortly."
"What else do you have?" Stone asked.
"He had an abnormal number of lacerations, even for an inmate. A few abrasions that were not related to his death."
"Where did the fatal blow strike him?" Stone asked.
"Bottom part of his heart. The rod got stuck in his rib cage. Shunt broke several ribs trying to get it free. But that's not what killed him."
"What?" Stone asked.
ME says that the rod scraped the bottom of the heart, but really didn't pierce it. The loss of blood would have killed him eventually. He lost a shitload of it in a hurry. But it still takes a while. He didn't die immediately. Died as the result of a blow to the throat that dislocated his windpipe."
"Could the officer have done that, or even known what he was doing?" Stone asked.
"Maybe. I don't know. Your prime witness is sitting right across from you. Why don't you ask him?"
"I'll get to him in a minute," Stone said with a quick glance in my direction. "What else can you tell us?"
"He was a drug user. There were traces of crack and alcohol in his blood."
"Crack?" Stone said.
Dust was visible in the shaft of sunlight shining in through the window, specks dancing in it. Amazingly, it seemed to avoid Stone.
"So his death could be drug-related," Daniel said.
"Aren't drug screenings done periodically?" I said.
"Yes, they are. He was tested as recently as a week ago, and it was negative. Besides, he was in confinement most of the time, which makes it virtually impossible to get drugs. Or anything else, for that matter."
"That's not what I've heard," I said.
"What have you heard?" Stone asked.
"That some strange things go on around here at night, especially in confinement." Neither man reacted or commented, and Daniels continued.
"He was, gay. Had AIDS.
There were traces of semen around his, on him. It is being processed at FDLE. Maybe we'll get lucky, and get something from it. Who knows? How about you, Chaplain? Stone asked. You discovered anything useful?
I have more, Daniel said.
Let's have it.
The lab also found some unusual trace evidence.
A pride chemical on his blues.
May give us an idea of where he was before he wound up in the trash heap.
Pride is a state-authorized, not-for-profit company that operates inside Florida state prisons, training inmates for general manufacturing and services. Many of the products created by Pride are used inside the prison.
Chaplain, what about being our prime witness? Can you tell us anything about the actual stabbing yesterday?
I really don't think I can add anything to what I've already said.
Should Shutt be looked into? He asked.
I nodded.
Okay, he said.
And then he looked at Daniels again.
Have you ever heard the old saying, you can catch more flies with honey than vinegar?
Sure, I've heard it, he said.
Well, the chaplain here is your honey. He is well-liked and respected, and he knows at least half of the staff pretty well. So you are to work with him and not without him, or you are not to work in this institution at all. Understand?
Yeah, I understand.
Understand, Chaplain? Stone said to me.
Yes, sir.
Good. Now go find out what's going on in my institution.
16.
There are a lot of things I regret.
Steve Roberts, Candace's live-in boyfriend, was saying. His maudlin disposition matched the liquor on his breath. We were sitting in a pair of rickety lawn chairs in the mostly dirt yard in front of his trailer, as Colby and Cody rode their bikes around the narrow streets of the subdivision.
Do you have regrets?
He asked. He was wearing a frayed wife beater, khaki cargo shorts a few sizes too big for his emaciated frame, and thin green dollar store flip-flops. He had a bottle of Beam in one hand, and a glass he kept refilling in the other.
Many, I said.
What do you do?
Live with them, I said.
And sometimes what you're doing.
Huh?
He asked.
What I'm doing?
Trying to drown them?
I guess I am. I feel so... I miss her so much. Don't know what I'd do if it weren't for them kids. Just trying to stay strong for them.
And doing a damn fine job of it, I thought. Do you have any idea where she might be? I asked. No matter how far-fetched it is? He shook his head and took another sip of his drink. Anyone harassing her or threatening her? Or was she having conflict with anyone at all? He shook his head again, and this time added a shrug.
Don't think so.
No. Did anything out of the ordinary happen in the days or weeks leading up to her disappearance? I asked. Anything at all?
No. Nothing. Her life? Our lives were just the same as they had always been. That's why I can't... Why this makes no sense. I mean... Who could have done something like this?
That's what we're trying to figure out, I said.
Oh, wait, he said. There was something. It wasn't like right before she went missing, but a few weeks before. One of her exes just started harassing her out of the blue.
Who?
Carl. No... Kevin. That's it? Kevin. Turner. I thought she said turnip the first time she said it.
Kevin Turner was harassing Candace a few weeks before she went missing? I asked.
Maybe it was more like a month.
What was he doing?
He'd call here drunk, follow her around and try to talk to her. Started hanging out at the bar during her shift a lot. Kept asking if Cody was his. One minute, he'd tell her they should get back together and raise him right. And the next, he was saying Cody wasn't his kid, and she wasn't getting a dime of child support out of him.
Every time Colby and Cody passed by on their bikes, they waved and spoke to me, and asked me to watch different tricks they could do. I couldn't help but notice they weren't saying anything to Steve, and I wondered why. Was it because he had seen all their tricks, and I was the new audience? Or something more sinister? Maybe they knew not to talk to him when he was this far into the bottle of beam.
Ain't a bad man, Steve said. I've had to deal with some shit in my life. Never caught a break. Not one. But that don't keep me from doing my best. I damn sure give more than I get. I can tell you that.
How are things between you and Candace?
I didn't have anything to do with this, man. I swear to Christ I didn't. We had our moments. I ain't perfect, but nothing big. We were no different than anybody else. I'd never hurt her. Besides, I couldn't. We only got the one car. I was stuck here with the kids. Went to bed early. Wasn't out running my girlfriend off the road and doing God knows what to her.
Have you been contacted by the Department of Children and Family Services about Colby and Cody? I asked. He nodded.
Case manager came out and talked to us. Asked the kids a bunch of questions. Did psychologicals on them. Said they could stay here for now, but they're looking for a relative they could go live with if their mom doesn't come back soon. Said that if the police ever say that I'm a person of interest, they'll be taken from me and put into foster care. So you make sure your dad knows I didn't do it. I don't want to lose these kids. I can't. They're all I got. All I got in the world.
17. By the time I got home from Steve's, Colby and Cody were there. I was happy to see them. I was looking forward to hearing about their day, talking to them about their mom, possibly sharing a pizza with them, and maybe playing some games or just hanging out. They made me less lonely, and I hoped I made them feel cared for and protected, and that I provided some stability for them. Did your mom ever talk to you about the future? I asked.
Like what?
Colby asked. As usual, when talking about her mom, her sad blue eyes grew sadder and bluer. Anything, I said. Plans? Things y'all might do? Places you might go? Anything like that? We were in my backyard, down by the river. Colby and I were sitting up on the bank in the shade of a cypress tree, Cody playing with action figures in the damp sand at the water's edge.
She used to always tell me she was sorry for not giving me a better life, and tell me she would make it up to me. She'd say, "Baby girl, things are going to get better. I promise you that. Your mama's going to do whatever it takes to make it happen."
Do you have any idea what she meant? I asked. What she might have been talking about? She shrugged her skinny shoulders, her long blonde hair spilling off of them as she did. And I was reminded of just how young she really was. Something I tended to forget when looking into her eyes or listening to her talk.
I know she felt bad for stuff I couldn't remember, she said. I know she was working hard to get us to a better place.
A passing boat sent waves out on either side of its wake, which by the time they reached the shore were small ripples for Cody's action figures to fight against. Did she and Steve get along well? I asked. She shook her head.
Not really. She yelled at him a lot.
Do you remember what about?
Not working? Not helping around the house? Drinking too much? Not being better? Doing better?
How does Steve treat you and Cody?
Okay. Mostly, I guess. He kind of does his own thing. Sleeps a lot. When he's awake, he watches TV and drinks.
I thought about that and wondered what the best thing for Colby and Cody was. Do you want to stay with Steve until we find your mom? Or would you like to stay somewhere else?
Where else would we go?
She asked, which broke my heart.
Well, a relative
or a foster parent, until...
Could we stay here with you?
She asked. I wish y'all could, I said. But the DCF officials who make the decisions about those sorts of things...
Why don't we get to make them?
She asked.
Shouldn't we get to say where we want to stay?
Yes, you should, I said. But the people who make the decisions are there to protect children. Since I'm not related to you, and I'm a single man, they'd never let me.
Steve's single, and he's a man?
I know, and I'm not sure how much longer they'll leave y'all with him. Since y'all were living with him before, and he's your mom's boyfriend, and with your mom being missing, they're probably waiting to see, waiting for her to be found and come home. I just wanted to make sure you and Cody were all right, and to see if you wanted to stay with Steve. If you didn't, I could let them know.
I guess we better stay where we are for now, she said.
Y'all are welcome here any time, I said. And if you ever need anything at all, just let me know.
I've heard people say that the longer somebody is missing, the more chances that they're probably dead.
I paused for a moment. I wanted to give her something that I couldn't, the promise of a happy ending. Since I couldn't do that, I could treat her with the respect she deserved and try to leave her with some semblance of hope. Before I could say anything, she spoke again.
I want to know the truth, she said. I really do.
I'm not going to give up until I find your mom, I said. And I have every hope of finding her alive. I really think that statistics or other people's opinions don't matter, because every case is different. And they're not going to change what happens in your mom's case. That's the truth.
I'm not sure it is, John, but okay.
Are y'all hungry? I asked. I could order a pizza.
Do you ever eat anything else?
She asked.
If you'll get some groceries, I'll cook. Or teach you how.
I can cook, I said.
What?
All sorts of things, I said. I grill a mean steak. I cook a good burger. I can make spaghetti, tacos.
John,
she said in the same voice she would use to scold Cody,
grilling a steak and three things with hamburger meat isn't all sorts of things. It's probably not even cooking.
18. Nights were the worst. The Tin Man, alone in his tin house. Loneliness, fear, isolation, guilt, an unquiet mind. The inability to sleep. After Colby and Cody left, I had attended an AA meeting, driving to the next county to ensure anonymity. It had helped, but not enough. I returned home and, in the absence of the prospect of sex with anyone other than myself, went jogging. At midnight, I had turned off the lights. That's when the neon lights inside my head came on. Thankfully, it wasn't long before the phone rang.
"This the chaplain what work for the Potter prison?"
an elderly black woman's voice asked. I could hear a loud television and a dog barking in the background.
"Yes, ma'am, it is. John Jordan."
"This is Miss Jenkins, Ike Johnson's aunt."
"Yes, ma'am. I'm so sorry about Ike."
"Thank you. We planned the funeral and wondered if you would do it."
I was stunned.
"We not really church peoples," she said.
"I'm not either," I thought.
"Ike's grandma, Miss Winger, said you's real nice to her."
I had spoken to Grandma Winger earlier that morning to tell her that her grandson, the one she had raised like a son, had been killed. At the time, I thought he was killed while trying to escape. She refused to believe it. She said that they were coming to visit him this Saturday, and he knew it. According to her, his current life was the best one he'd ever had. "When is the funeral?" I asked.
"Saturday, if you's able to make it. Can you do it Saturday?"
"Yes, I can. I will." I rolled over after hanging the phone on its cradle and stared up at the ceiling. It hadn't changed. The breeze outside caused the aluminum of the trailer to bend in and out, making the sound of a whip cracking. I sat up. I lay back down. I decided to get up and work on Ike's funeral some. I stumbled down the hallway into the living room and made some notes. Preparing the funeral sermon of a stranger killed under suspicious circumstances was challenging. I grew weary, but I still couldn't sleep. On my way back to bed, I stopped by the bathroom. Looking in the mirror, I discovered I looked as tired as I felt. As I turned to head back to bed, I noticed a small pile of clothes near the shower. It was about 2 days' worth. I smiled as I thought of how Susan hated that. Having that thought gave me a strong urge to leave them there, which I only overcame because if I left them in reaction to her, she would still be controlling my life. I bent down and scooped them up, slinging one sock between my legs as I did. When I reached for it, I saw something that stopped my heart. On the back of my left leg, there was a cut about 2 inches long. I dropped the clothes and bent down even farther to take a closer look. It wasn't very deep, but still deep enough for AIDS-infected blood splattered on it to get into my bloodstream. When did I get it? Was it today? Or before what happened in the Sallyport? For the second time that night, my phone rang. I rushed to the phone, grabbing the receiver as I climbed into bed.
John, the voice said. John.
Slightly slurred, slightly desperate, slightly scared. The voice was the voice I heard within the sound of my own when I had been drinking. It was the voice of my mother, and she only called me John when she was drunk.
John, answer me. Are you there?
I'm here.
They got me locked up again. I'm dying. You've got to come see me soon.
Mom, you're not dying. It just feels like it. It's withdrawals.
No, you don't understand. I haven't been drinking. Come see me before it's too late. I love you. I love you, John. You've always been my favorite.
You tell everybody that when you're drunk. She started coughing. It sounded as if she dropped the phone. Her act was definitely improving. It took maybe 2 minutes, which seemed like 30, for her to pick up the phone again. When she did, she said,
I've got to see you, son, before I die.
What you've got to do is get sober. I'm hanging up now. Call me when you're sober. 19. The next morning, as I was meeting with inmates and opening mail, I received another typed note. Like before, it was a single piece of typing paper, trifolded, taped, with one typewritten word on the outside. Chaplain. I carefully peeled back the tape and opened it. I could tell immediately that it was produced by the same typewriter as the other one. It read,
Chaplain, if you don't back off, I'm going to kill you. Just back off, or you're dead. I will kill you and that girl you love. Killing's better than fucking. I love it. I will probably fuck her, and then kill her. But I might kill her, then fuck her. Back off.
The institutional mail was delivered every day but Sunday. The note had probably been sent the previous night. Who was it about? I was in love with Anna, but was it obvious to anyone? The other note had spoken of protection, now this one of threat. Were they about two different women? Anna and who? Sandy Strickland? Who else had I been seen with recently? My office door opened, and Tom Daniels walked in. I nodded toward one of the chairs across from my desk as I carefully folded the letter and stuck it in my desk drawer. He sat down. Looking better than he had yesterday, his face wasn't as red, his eyes not as bloodshot. He looked down at the clipboard that he was carrying, flipped through a couple of pages, then looked back up at me.
Look, the warden said we've got to work together. Neither of us is happy about it. But what you gonna do, right?
I knew the warden's words alone were not enough to bring about this change in him.
The investigation is more important than our dislike of one another. Wouldn't you agree?
I don't dislike you. I'd like to talk with you about what happened.
I've heard your excuses before.
I've never offered any excuses. You've only heard things from Susan. He shook his head.
Don't want to talk about it. Just concentrate on the work. I don't like you, but I can work with anyone.
I'm sorry for any pain I've caused you or your family. I love Susan. Only want the best for her. He was unable to hide his obvious awkwardness and discomfort.
We need to follow up some of the leads that our physical evidence has produced, he said. You could do some of them without anyone noticing. IG of the department walks in and starts asking questions. People get nervous and clam up.
No wonder he was being civil. He needed my help. Like what? I asked.
The lab said there were traces of a chemical on Johnson's pants that's used in floor cleaner and wax in medical and dental facilities. We've traced the exact chemical to two types of cleaners, manufactured by Pride. The cleaners are used in the medical offices, the infirmary, and the dental offices.
We know he was in the infirmary the night before he was killed.
But he couldn't get it on him from just being there, even if he fell on a recently mopped floor. Besides, the chemical on his pants had not been diluted. He'd have had to come in contact with an actual bottle of cleaner, and it'd have to have been within a few hours of his death.
We need to find out if he ever worked with a cleaner, or if his uniform was switched with someone else's. Happens a lot. Uniform could have come in contact with the chemical when another inmate was wearing it.
He shook his head. I doubt it. The chemical had not been through the washer and dryer, and the uniform had his name tag on it. It actually stuck to the spear. How about medical and dental?
I'll check them again as I can. I have to continue my regular work as well, and I've been asked to do Ike Johnson's funeral on Saturday.
Find out all you can about him from his family, he said. They may know something useful and not know they know it.
I nodded.
I think it's best if we're not seen together. You do those things. I'll talk with Fortner, make him feel a part of the investigation, and continue to check with the lab.
Working together without working together. It was ingenious. 20. Merrill Monroe, my best friend since elementary school, was an African-American correctional officer sergeant in charge of outside grounds. Inmates assigned to his crew were not considered escape risks and were allowed to work outside the gate. I found him in a garden to the left of the institution, down on his hands and knees, showing an inmate just how to plant sugar snap peas. The light brown sleeves of his short-sleeved CO uniform were stretched tightly over muscular dark brown arms. Every time he moved, his muscles flexed, straining his shirt to the point of ripping. As he instructed the inmate on exactly how to do his job, he spoke in slow, even tones. I had seen him stare down a gang of inmates, two with shanks, the same way. I had also seen him wipe out an entire gang by himself, never raising his voice, and never acting as if it required much effort, either. Sarge, you got a minute? I asked as I came up behind him. He stood, nodding at me, and pointing at the row of peas to the inmate. We walked away from the garden and the inmates working there for some privacy. I was thinking of planting some sugar snap peas and needed some help.
Shit. Yo ass ever planted anything in your life?
Not too late to start, is it? Really am about to put some sod around my trailer.
Want some advice? He said.
From an expert like yourself?
Of course. Put the green side up, he said,
a broad smile creeping across his face, revealing his startling white teeth. We were both silent a moment. He glanced back in the direction of the garden. I could tell he was not happy with how the inmates were planting the peas. It's hard to get good help these days, I said.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I heard about what you did in the Sallyport on Tuesday. Pretty impressive for a skinny white boy.
I'm not skinny, I protested. I'm fit.
You's fit before all that shit in Atlanta, he said. Now you's skinny.
He stood directly in front of me, positioning himself between me and the sun, the shadow he cast keeping me from needing the shades I had left in my office. He was always doing things like that, and never mentioning it. I could see my reflection in his glasses. I looked distorted, like my face was too big for my head and body. Merrill towered over my 6 feet by about 4 inches, totally eclipsing the sun.
Anyway, he continued, you did good. Showed some of these rednecks that a man can be civilized and have balls, too.
Did Johnson work for you?
On paper.
My eyebrows shot up.
Oh, really? He was assigned to outside grounds, but never came. Each month I got a note from Captain Skipper saying he using Johnson other places. Just go ahead and give him credit for working out here.
And you did it? I asked, a little surprised.
Captain say do it? I do it, he said,
falling back into his favorite dialect for expressing his frustration.
I not smart enough to think for myself. Don't ask no questions. No, sir.
Merrill thought for himself all right, and asked plenty of questions. As smart as any man I'd ever met, Merrill had been unable to attend college. Instead, he had spent much of his time at the public library, and already had a much better education than most college graduates.
Did he ever show up out here for work? I asked. When he was first assigned here? Came out about 3 times. Didn't do a damn thing. Worried about his fingernails and hair too much.
Oh, yeah?
Inmates called him Go-Down, because he a go-down on anybody.
I nodded, thinking about the picture developing of little Ike Johnson.
You tell me anything about Hardy, CO who works nights in the infirmary?
Ex-military, he said. Still in the reserves. Hell of a good officer. Smart, tough, fair. He not as good as me, but he's good.
Pretty confident for a black man named after a dead white woman.
He ran his hand across his short hair and then started patting it.
With good reason.
Anything else about Johnson you can think of?
Didn't know him that well. But I'll tell you who did. Inmate named Willie Baker. Probably the oldest homosexual on the compound. Hell, maybe even in the world.
The one they call Grandma? I asked.
He smiled.
Yeah, he said with surprise and amusement. Chaplain got the 411.
That's me, Mr. Information. But it's not the 411, but the 911 that concerns me. You ever get a request from Johnson? Was it typed?
He shook his head.
Nigga couldn't read or write.